been protecting Canada's Arctic sovereignty for the past 72 years.
I'm just watching the great powers in between me and down there and over there. And it's almost like a bad nightmare.
Wait for that.
Greatest defense is about to become your softest underbelly. China and Russia, the great powers, and the United States fighting it out over the Arctic is going to be the new great game of the 21st century. Canada, you are thrust into the middle of that. And quite frankly, you're the great prize of that. When you guys think through the hard decisions that have to be made, particularly the Arctic, particularly hemispheric defense, particularly geoeconomically, what this means, internal logic is going to drive you that somehow we have to figure out how to partner with the United States. That's what President Trump's genius is.
There's something uniquely terrifying about the realization that the ideas of people like Steve Bannon shape global events. But they do. He and other men who use the term geopolitical more than they ought to have been banging on about the Arctic for some time now. Some of these dudes have podcasts. Some of them have the ears of world leaders. And some of them have both. And now, the notion that Canada must drop everything to race up north to protect the Arctic is suddenly everywhere, including in Pierre Poilievre's platform. And just 4 days after Mark Carney became prime minister, he flew up to Nunavut to announce a $6 billion radar defense program. At a minimum, these new adventures are going to change some people's lives. People living in Canada's north will find themselves at the center of major world events. Again. Turns out, this is not the first time that our political discourse got overheated with anxieties about some hypothetical snowy battle on a glacier to come, some fantasy of an imminent icy World War III. And the last time it happened, who paid the price? Who was sent to claim our northern border? To let the commies know we didn't just own some Arctic, we were also using it. Who? Larry. His name is Larry. And of the people who were sent up there with Larry, well, he's the last of them who is still up there. And our senior producer, Bruce Thorson, got Larry on the phone just the other week. Wait for it.
The way Larry tells the story, it starts like this.
Beautiful September morning, calm, yet calm. I guess you would call it the Inuit version of Indian summer, I guess, in September in the beginning. Beautiful, warm day.
Two men were walking along the shore when they first saw it. It was maybe a kilometer offshore. A small boat. It couldn't have been longer than about 20 feet. Not the kind of boat you'd expect to see bobbing up and down in the open ocean. And the guy in the boat, well, they definitely weren't expecting him. He was a stranger. Obviously, in a town with a population of just under 150, everybody knows everybody. Or as Larry puts it,
people know who's who. There are days when you don't care to know about your neighbor's dirty laundry. That's the life in a small community. It's like living in a little fishbowl. But this man thought otherwise. He thought nobody would know him, that he could get away with it. And he almost did.
As Larry says, he almost got away with it. But maybe that's because the stranger was trying to get away with, was, to put it bluntly, nuts. Larry and his neighbors don't get many surprise visitors. After all, there's no roads connecting them to any other towns. The nearest other town is about 360 kilometers away. As for airports, the town's sole airstrip is only about 500 meters long. It's mostly good for twin otters, small, tough planes like that. The runway isn't even paved. It's just a strip of gravel surrounded by mountains. You need special training just to attempt a landing. So yeah, not a lot of tourists. This little boat bobbing up and down in the ocean was definitely something new. Eventually, the Mounties would start to piece it together. Turns out this solo sailor had braved 1,500 kilometers of open ocean to reach Larry's town. He'd sailed from a small village down south, in Greenland. Let's face it, there's not a lot of people in the world who can say things like, you know, that town, down south, in Greenland. The name of the town where the sailor set out from is Holsteinborg. But this guy, he's no Holsteinborger. Soon, the cops would learn he was in fact Romanian.
Well, I think he was nuts in the first place. Here's a man who's not thinking like you and I would normally.
It's a crazy story. Like, what did you think? I mean, it was a small boat, and he came up from Greenland. He traveled over 1,000 kilometers. I'm guessing there were icebergs along the way. I don't know how long that trip would have taken. It's kind of a miracle to me that he ever got there, but it seems completely nuts. What did you think about his seamanship, or was it just a miracle he survived? It seems like a very treacherous journey. Like, what did people think when they saw this little boat?
Yeah, well, the passage that he took, that area is very treacherous. He almost drowned if he had capsized. His windshield got hit by ice, water after water, and the windshield came off. He almost didn't make it.
They didn't know much about this guy, but they did get one clue to his success in navigating the treacherous Arctic waters. When the sailor finally stepped ashore, a horseshoe fell out of his because it turns out that by the time he got to town, he only had about a gallon of fuel left. That's just enough to take him somewhere around 5 more nautical miles. He'd made it, but no one was expecting him to stay in town. So the locals asked where he was headed. And the sailor said he was going to Toronto. Oh, Toronto. Just another town down south. 3,600 kilometers down south. And the sailor did have a name. Florin Fodor. The locals, despite being surprised to see him wash up on their shore, well, they'd been waiting for Florin Fodor for 54 years. There's a picture of Fodor from that time. This was back in 2006 when he landed. It's pixelated, blurry, but you can see a stocky man. He's about 32 years old, wearing a gray sweater, camo pants that belong on a hunter, a baseball hat, and he's standing on his little boat. And seriously, it looks like the kind of mucking about fishing boat you'd find on a prairie lake. It doesn't even look like there's room for him to lay down in the thing. Larry's hometown, the place where Florin Fodor landed, is called Grise Fjord. It's on the southern tip of Ellesmere Island, and it's the northernmost town in Canada. Larry's lived there nearly all of his 75 years.
My name is Larry Outlaluk. I'm from Greech Fjord, and I'm a hunter, former hunter guide. And by trade, I'm a truck driver and gas station attendant, that kind of work.
Larry is also humble. Apart from being a polar bear hunter and a trucker, Larry's an author. His book is called What I Remember, What I Know, The Life of a High Arctic Exile. It was shortlisted for the Governor General's Award for Nonfiction. Here's some old tape of a younger Larry laying out the start of his own story.
I remember the cold mornings when we were living in a tent the first year.
This audio comes from a 30-year-old NFB documentary called Broken Promises.
Our first year or two, it was, I remember the mornings being very cold and the walls being very dark. And years later, I found out those were old Buffalo Heights, which were used for insulation in our tent.
In 1953, Larry was just 3 years old, and he was living in a tent in Greece Fjord because there was no town there. At that point, it was just a handful of tents for seven Inuit families, totaling 87 people. Larry is Inuit, but his family didn't belong in Greece Fjord. None of the 87 people stranded on the shore belonged there. They'd been transplanted to this barren shore by the RCMP.
There was nothing up here, and we didn't have any infrastructure, and in fact, my family was not to get any kind of shelter, and it was a very difficult time for us.
Greece Fjord was an alien land for Larry's family. Their ancestral home was nearly 2,000 kilometers south in Quebec. So why was Larry's family dropped on the frozen shores of Ellesmere Island? The answer? Sovereignty. In the 1950s, Russia and the Americans were staring each other down, aiming Cold War nuclear weapons across the Arctic.
The Arctic. Desolate. Savage. Remote. A wilderness of unending barren vistas.
This is a clip from a 1950s newsreel.
Through most of the year, locked in bitter cold and almost endless darkness. In the short summers, a swamp-like morass. Not too bad for caribou or polar bears, but no place for human beings. Yet this roof of the world holds a stark menace to our country, to our very existence.
Laying out the Cold War battleground and its focus on the North.
The menace lies in the basic new fact of our time that no two nations on Earth are any longer cut off from each other by geography. What was once the impassable Arctic now provides the quickest routes for attack from a wide sector of Europe and Asia. Beset by the nightmare of this threat.
The Canadian government worried about the Russians, but also the Americans, who were eyeing northern military bases. Canada was wondering about its claim to really be a nation stretching from coast to coast to coast. So a plan was born in Ottawa. Transplant a group of Inuit from northern Quebec north to Ellesmere Island, inhabit the island, and cement our northern claims. So how did the government get 87 people from northern Quebec to leave their homes, their families, their way of life, and move 2,000 kilometers north to the high Arctic, sight unseen? Well, they made some promises.
When we were being moved, I have read some documentation about the relocation, that we were to be looked after, that we did not have to worry about anything. We just come and pack up our sleeping bags and tents and hunting equipment, our dog teams, and get on the ship, and we will go to a place where we can live well. We will be looked after.
And of course, the plan worked perfectly, and they all lived happily ever after. No, you're not buying that?
Unfortunately, it didn't happen the way it was described. Sadly, that did not happen. And my father figured out what was going on when he realized that the government had no intention of honoring their promises. That's where that word broken promises was used one time in the documentary.
The Broken Promises documentary highlights RCMP documents talking about Larry's father and his fate. Larry's father's nickname was Fatty.
Fatty was our leader. He was our father. The people that took us there misled us about what we should have found. So he used to say, they promised we were going back. They promised that we were going to have a steady diet of caribou. His spirit started to slow down when he realized that it was not going to be as they had promised. His spirits fell fast, and he didn't make it throughout the first year.
RCMP report, Craig Harbor, 1954. One death occurred, Fatty, E9713, due to heart attack.
So we lived up here, and mother cries for help were ignored. They were not even heard. Many of the people wanted to go back home. And so we felt betrayed, of course.
So, recap. In 1953, the feds are fretting over Russian and American moves on the Arctic. Sound familiar? They moved a group of Inuit families 2,000 kilometers north to plant the flag on Ellesmere Island. In a sadly predictable chain of events, promises were not kept. No housing, no reliable food sources. Oh, and by the way, the sun will disappear for 3 months. According to Larry, the people moved north weren't told that small detail. Watching the days disappear until there's nothing but night for 3 months? Nothing but the dark season.
The dark season had a very deadly, in a way, consequences that my parents talked about. And the dark season was such bad influence on everyone.
The move was a tangle of lies and harebrained schemes fueled by political paranoia. But over the decades, the people of Greasefjord did build up a town. Today, the population of just under 150 has much of what you'd expect in a northern community. Homes, a school, an RCMP detachment, a small landing strip, a clinic, but no doctor. Greasefjord became what Ottawa in the 1950s wanted it to be. Canada's northernmost town, a bulwark against the northern ambitions of other countries. And those 1950s worries might sound a bit familiar.
At a time when Canadians have become increasingly concerned about sovereignty, Canada's new Prime Minister went north of 60 to shore up Arctic security.
We cannot and should not look first to others to defend our nation.
The Arctic is important for both Russia and the world, and competition over the region is intensifying.
And I also have a message tonight for the incredible people of Greenland. We need Greenland for national security and even international security, and we're working with everybody involved to try and get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it.
Yeah, this is the point in the story where we jump to today. We're talking about the upcoming election. Because today, despite the fact that it feels like we're in uncharted waters, in many ways, all this northern saber-rattling and plans for land grabs echoes the 1950s.
In 1953, there were 87 people shipped to Grease Fjord. And of the original 87, Larry is the last one still there. His life has literally been shaped by the Canadian government's desire to fly the flag in the North. So who better to ask about what this election means up North?
How does this all look to you from where you're sitting?
We are watching on the sideline. We're listening to one conversation to the south, and then we're listening to the other conversation to our left towards the east, which is towards China and Russia, and we don't feel comfortable. I sure don't. What's going to happen if there's any kind of a conflict, if it ever should come? I mean, it is not comfortable. I don't have a place to go into for shelter if a war ever breaks out between those great countries. And I'm in the middle of it. Where am I going to go? Inside the ice cap? I don't have a capability to go inside the ice cap or these mountains. Not like they can with President Trump, all his protection.
How has it changed over the last few years for you? Because it is the politics that is alarming. But part of it has to do with global warming and the changes in the Northwest Passage. And there's been a lot of change in the last 10, 20 years. So I'm wondering from your viewpoint, what have you been seeing?
Okay.
What has changed?
Well, I have been listening for years, for a long time, and still waiting. Where are those submarines? Where are those icebreakers? I haven't seen any of them yet. I see some great big icebreakers from Russia going up to North Pole, and then I'm watching also from Greece, we are looking at north with the polar continent itself work with border issues with our allies at the time with Denmark and the other Swedish countries. I see promises all over again. They're going to do this, they're going to do that. We haven't seen anything. Our little runways, very short. We don't have enough infrastructure up here. I'm watching all those promises. So it is still unnerving. It's still, I'm still nervous. I'm just watching the great powers in between me and down there and over there. And it's almost like a bad nightmare.
It's time to bring Florin Fodor back. I never did tell you how his story ended. We'd left him floating offshore.
So he is coming in. He's still a couple of kilometers, maybe at least a kilometer from shore. He started shouting to guys that were off to work in the morning because he was 9 o'clock. So he's shouting, "Any of you guys want to buy a boat?" And the boatswain says, "Yes, how much?" And they negotiated a price. And he still hasn't hit the ground. The Canadian saw yet. So we're going to rush up to the squab, and knowing that there's somebody at the squab around 9 in the morning, and he went to get the money. And in the meantime, when the guy landed, after he landed, he asked the other fellow, he said, "Where is the RCMP where I can get my passport stamped?" "Right over here," and pointing it to the RCMP detachment. And in a way, it was, for me, it was comical. He went inside, and he never left again until he was in shackles.
Fodor came ashore, headed to the RCMP detachment, hoping to get his passport stamped. And that's where his adventure, at least as much of it as he'd planned, ended. The Mounties ran a check on his name, and it turned out this wasn't his first attempt to get into Canada.
While the guy was still inside the police station, he decided to look at his computer further, look at the guy's background, and he found all kinds of things to detain him. It turns out he had been trying to come to Canada a number of times to Toronto and being turned down. That's when he realized something is not right.
They said he was on his way to Toronto, which just seemed outrageous again. Like, it's outrageous enough to go from Greenland to Grisfjord, but then to think I'm going to go from Grisfjord to Toronto is almost as outrageous.
Yeah, when the plane came in to pick him up, the two immigration guys, one behind him, one in front of them, and he was in backward, just like in the movies.
Right. Your premier, a little after that, talked about him, and if I'm remembering correctly, said something to the effect that that's why Grisfjord was there. We were there to establish sovereignty, and she was making a larger point about let's be responsible for the people of Grisfjord because they're doing a job. And the whole reason we moved people here was to catch guys like this, right? And when I heard that, I kind of went, well, yeah, that's kind of why the people were moved there. Because you can talk about sovereignty, but what it actually means is when another person shows up who isn't Canadian, your job is to say, this person's here, we're going to deal with it. So it's almost like, you know, it was a surprise that he got there, but it was kind of the job that you guys were supposed to be doing, according to the federal government. Like, does that make any sense to you?
Yes, you make perfect sense. And having been to North Dakota from Winnipeg, and I noted, wow, what a great number of flags these neighbors of ours in the South fly. And I could hardly see any of ours. We saw them, but they were almost outnumbered 1-6, more than what we do. So if you come to my place, I would introduce you to my flagpole. I found a very long Siderian log, and I put it up along my house. I tied it down, and I put another piece on it so that I can attach the flag. So I have a Canadian flag right outside my house because it does to show to the world, hey, we're from Greece here. Look, here's my flag. We're proud. We're Canadian. Living a life up here.
That is your Canada Land episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Tune in tomorrow for our politics edition, where Noor and the team will explore the question, is Alberta going to break away from Canada and form their own country? And are we going to like fight them in some bloody civil war about that? Or what the heck's going to happen? That's tomorrow. Don't miss it. You can email me about today's show. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com, and I read everything that you send. Today's show was written and presented by our senior producer, Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Fact check today by Julian Abraham. Max Collins is our director of audio. I am the publisher and editor of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Canada Land, funded by you.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news, and holy the news should be about last night's English language leaders debate, but instead, what could we possibly talk about but the absolute show that went down at the debate between Ezra Levant, Kian Bextie, and the reporters who Bextie and Levant got into a series of ugly confrontations with.
Speaking quietly doesn't make your things any less.
You're completely out of control emotionally. And your facts are completely wrong.
All right,
and an embarrassment. What's your name?
Oh, wait for that. Welcome back to the show, Jan Wong.
Hi.
We are hearing from the debate commission that the scrums tonight have been canceled.
The reason that they gave officially at the microphone was that they didn't feel that they could provide or guarantee a proper environment for the scrums. And this obviously comes on the heels of some unusual scrums last night and a situation last night that I know we've been reporting on, but also tension in the room and confrontations that were happening between journalists.
Jan, what the hell?
I know.
Okay, it's Thursday night. We have stayed up to rendezvous here after the debates, and we were supposed to talk about the debates and do some criticism of what we saw there, but a complete show has broken out amongst the press. We're just getting confirmation of the details of this. I think we could probably provide a pretty good account.
Tell us what happened.
The scrum after the debate has been called off. And this is like where reporters get to ask questions of the politicians after the debate. And it's been canceled. And all the debate commission has said is it's because of security concerns. What security concerns? What are these security concerns? Is somebody threatened the politicians?
Somebody might hit somebody with a laptop.
It's a security concern among the press. This is about concerns that the press are going to get into a fist fight. And the reason for this is because of what happened before the debates.
And also what happened yesterday after the French debate.
Yes, right? And that was the lead this up to this. And I'm sorry this is going to be a bit out of order. But first, let's just hear, this is how the CBC is reporting on why there's no scrum. What is the security concern that led to this? Here's what was said by Rosemary Barton and David Cochran and Adrian Arsenault explaining to their viewers why there's no scrum.
Just so people understand, there are a series of police officers stationed behind us to make sure that we remain safe and that the media get out safely. There were not altercations between journalists inside the media room, and there was no altercation between journalists that happened on David's set. These were right-wing people that publish their own agenda and websites who confronted journalists inside the media center, who confronted David on his set, who directly and personally confronted me inside the media center. These are people that the commission decided to accredit, and that is where we are now. The situation deteriorated quickly in terms of how those people were behaving inside a professional media center where you were supposed to be doing your job. And that has left us with no scrums and a strange security situation on a night where we should be focused on the things that you want to ask us about.
It certainly didn't look like this last night.
Just one point on that. We are inside a secure perimeter. You have to go through screening processes that involved the RCMP. This set we were on, they came in with bomb-sniffing dogs, searched our bags to make sure everything was safe. That's to make sure the leaders are safe and everybody in here is safe. And for whatever reason, the way this evolved throughout the day and yesterday, the Montreal police are here putting up caution tape, escorting people out. And the leaders of Canada's four parties who were able to participate in this debate, because they, what was the phrase, didn't feel they could provide or guarantee a proper environment, they're not going to take questions from journalists. And look, I know not everybody thinks it's all about us, but it is an important part of the ritual of elections and democracies and accountability. And it is part of the stress test that these leaders go through as they seek to lead this country, you know, and spend your tax revenue and make laws. And some serious things being discussed here tonight about criminal justice and using the notwithstanding clause. These are all things that require a serious and mature debate, not financially motivated stunts. And this is where we've ended up in this election. With everything going on with Donald Trump and everything going on in this economy and everything going on in the world, this is where the national Canadian election debate has ended up. And it's just exhausting. And it is the end product of multiple years of rage farming for narrow political gain and financial benefit for a very small group of people who blew this up today.
And Canadians, as a result, don't get one more rare opportunity to hear the leaders answer questions.
Okay, that's interesting. Very interesting.
It's very interesting. Rosemary Barton looks rattled and angry, and David Cochran is smacking the table, and they're saying that there's police here, and though this is secure, they had to call off the scrum because they couldn't guarantee anybody's safety. But here's the thing. They're not telling us what happened.
Yeah, they talked about an altercation, and Rosie Barton said, but not among journalists. It was the people, these right-wing splinter groups. There was something happened, but we don't know what happened. Did somebody get punched?
She knows what happened because it happened to her. Who are these people who are not journalists that she's referring to? This is the basics of who, what, when, where, and how. And I appreciate that they don't want to be the center of attention, but obviously they got drawn into the story here and they're very angry about it.
Well, they are the story. This is the story now.
They are the story, and they're talking about who's not a journalist and who's just here to rage farm. We can tell our listeners who it is. This has to do with Ezra Levant. That's who they're talking about. And it has to do with Kian Bexty. And I think we got to back up here because this chapter of it started last night when a lot of people noticed that the press scrum after the French debate was filled with non-traditional journalists.
Hello, Mr. Singh. Drea Humphrey with Rebel News.
There were four media personalities from the Rebel. There was Kian Bexty from his Juno News outlet. There were also questions asked by people from, according to Steve Faguet, who tweeted about this, some left-leaning outfits. And ultimately, the CBC didn't get to ask any more questions than Rebel News did. Here's Kian Bexty asking a question to Mark Carney.
Your entire campaign does seem to be predicated on putting you in the front and hiding the people that stood in lockstep with Justin Trudeau for the last 10 years. You're kind of hoping that Canadians won't connect the dots that the people standing behind you in your caucus walked in lockstep with them. Regardless of what you say right now, Stephen Gilboa made the carbon taxes life work. The man that moved Paul Bernardo from a maximum security prison is now your chief of staff. I'm wondering how you reconcile this and how you can trust their judgment when they thought those ideas were good ideas.
I'd say a couple things to that rather odd question. First,
Jan, the background of this is that Rebel Media was denied entry to a prior debate. They did not get press credentials years ago when they wanted them, right? And they sued along with the True North Center in 2019, and they won. The Debate Commission is this body that was created by Justin Trudeau. I think he had Craig Kilberger as a part of it. It's controversial in its own right. Kilberger's no longer involved. They run the debates. And so they didn't want Rebel there. And the grounds they gave was because of the Rebels' activist activities, because of their advocacy that they shouldn't get the same access as journalists. Rebel and True North sue and win. And there was a lot of talk amongst the journalists. How did they get so many questions that they somehow gamed the system was what I was hearing.
I think I read that they stacked the line, which means that they put in extra people.
Yeah.
So that others can't get to the front. I don't understand why they got accredited. I think the story is really the Leaders Debate Commission, who seem to have bungled the debates this time around. It's a commission. You said Justin Trudeau set it up. First of all, they had to, at the last minute, move the time of the French debate for a hockey game. That's the first blunder. The second one is they wouldn't let the Green Party be on stage. And they had these rules, you have to have 4% of the votes, you have to have a seat in Parliament. But it just looked weird that you would have the Bloc Québécois on a national stage, but not the Greens. So that's another problem. And they accredited Rebel News, even though Rebel News had registered as a third-party advocacy group. The commission didn't do the basic due diligence. They didn't check, are you actually an advocacy group?
So there's a detail in there that I want to unpack a little bit, because I don't think that the debate commission at this point with the court order had any option but to give them the accreditation. But meanwhile, at the French language debates on Wednesday night, while the Rebels' media personalities are there, you know, as reporters, there is a truck outside the event shortly before the debate, like a billboard truck, and it's showing anti-Carney messages, arguably conspiracy stuff, the World Economic Forum stuff. Whose truck is it? That truck, it turns out, is owned by a group that is a third-party advertiser that belongs to Ezra Levant. And this was not known by the debate commission. So I don't know if that would have affected things if they had known, but maybe that would have given new grounds to bar them entry. The reporters I was hearing from were just appalled that the Rebel had gamed the system. And it was making it hard for reporters to do their job. So this is the background, okay? And the media is all converging on the English language debates, which is like pretty high stakes. It's basically Pierre Poilievre's last chance in hell to turn this around. Like, you know, the fate of the country, blah, blah, blah. So here's the account via our colleague Aviva. Many journalists were chatting about what happened last night where members of Rebel News managed to get in line first and ask a number of long-winded non-questions. Juno and True North also asked questions. There was talk about whether or not the rules would be different tonight. So Stuart Benson is a reporter with the Hill Times. He's been on our shows before, and he was there. It's about 30 minutes before the debate started. Stuart, who was sitting at the desk, and Kian Bexty started talking. Kian was sitting behind Stuart. Kian was next to a Rebel News reporter. Kian, remember, is no longer with the Rebel. He's now with this Juno News.
Also, the dudes are being kind of homophobic. That's one.
Do you have friends that you get pretty homophobic at times?
Yeah, most of my gay friends.
Most of your gay friends. No, I'm not. I'm curious. What, do you just think that politicians should be off the hook for saying stuff like this?
What, 15 years ago? How long ago?
He was 30.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry,
so
who are you?
He wasn't a politician?
Their discussion escalated. They were arguing about which candidate is homophobic or something like that. Aaron Gunn was mentioned.
And just because he's a liberal, you're trying to defend him.
No.
If this was a conservative...
Also, if it was, okay, so if it was a conservative, you would call for him to be removed, like Aaron
Gunn? Oh, absolutely. But Aaron Gunn hasn't said something like that.
Stuart started raising his voice.
Because you're clearly not doing any actual journalism while you're here.
You're supposed to maintain respectful discourse. It's right here in black and white.
Why? When you guys started gaming the rules and threatening to sue because you didn't get your way, I assumed the rules were out the window.
Stuart noticed people were filming him, so he started to speak up for the camera.
Most of us didn't get a question. And what I really don't enjoy is that everyone else here was being respectful, following the rules, just being considerate to everyone else. And what you guys decided to do was to take advantage, threaten to sue, so that you could try to get more than everyone else. And now, nobody likes you.
Ezra, sitting across the room, started to get involved.
He has third-party advertising trucks driving around this venue.
You're lying
right now.
That's not a Rebel News ad on there. Completely out of control emotionally. And your facts are completely wrong.
Right,
you're an embarrassment. What's your name? What's your name? You're suddenly shy.
No, I'm Googling.
You're Googling your name?
Ezra sort of maintaining the soft-spoken voice as Stuart is yelling across the room, and there's all these journalists are watching on here.
Why don't you tell us who you are, tough guy?
Stuart Benson, Hill Times.
Stuart Benson, well, you're a disgrace to the Hill Times, and your facts are wrong.
You're a disgrace.
Ezra accused him of throwing a tantrum and said that they were going to start calling him Tantrum Boy.
Tantrum Boy. I'll call you Tantrum Boy.
This continued for like five-ish minutes. Everyone was listening.
God.
Ezra was asked to leave or escorted out. We don't know which, but Ezra Levant was the one who was made to leave. People were gathering around the exit. So Aviva says, I went to look. They told me Ezra was out there talking to the commissioner or something like that. He eventually comes back in and starts a media scrum.
Your counsel, we were actually talking about the CBC who want us out of here. The CBC want us kicked out. We're not leaving. The CBC were outraged that Mr. Cormier let us in. The CBC had four questions yesterday. Rebel News had four questions yesterday. The CBC thinks that's normal, and it's abnormal that we do.
Of course, this is the media doing a media scrum. Oh, my God.
Yeah, we don't get a scrum from the party leaders, but Ezra gives a scrum where he's talking about how the CBC wanted him out of there. All right, stick around after the break. I mean, we've only told you half of the that went down. Now, independently, we were hearing like third-hand reports that Ezra was aggressive and Rosemary and David, that it was like very unsettling. I would not be repeating this because we didn't have it verified enough. But then Rosemary went to air and referenced this.
These were right-wing people that publish their own agenda and websites who confronted journalists inside the media center, who confronted David on his set, mm-hmm. who directly and personally confronted me inside the media center.
Okay, so something went down between Ezra and Rosemary. So I think that as a result of whatever happened in this second altercation between Ezra Levant and the CBC, this led to the CBC asking that Rebel News not be allowed to stay. And then we have the scrum being called off entirely.
It was actually about, what's his name, the bald guy on the CBC? David Cochran. Yeah, I mean, Cochran wanted me kicked out. I ain't leaving. Cochran's really thin-skinned. I talked to Rosemary Barton, too. I invited her to a challenge, and she declined. But that has nothing to do with it. Anyways, I want to get back to the journalism here, but it's a pleasure to be in the center of the attention.
So, Jan, and I am aware of how ludicrous this is, this schoolyard antics. And then ultimately the principal saying everybody's got to go home, playtime's over. But this did actually have an impact on a major press availability here.
Wow.
There's another account I'll play. I'll play two more things. So our colleague Aviva went to Stuart Benson, the guy who was first heard there yelling, and asked him for a comment, and was able to record him reflecting on what had just occurred. But in the background, you can hear Steve Paikin starting to host a national leaders debate. So he's almost inaudible.
Leaders, why did you want to speak up? In Montreal for what I'm sure will be a memorable evening. Our first
profession
is tariffs and
the
threats
institution,
to Canada.
And I think this is an important exercise in democracy that needs to be taken seriously and not made a mockery.
And the first question goes to Mr.
Carney. Are you happy with how it went down? Or?
Okay. What is the starting point for negotiations,
I said
Mr. Carney,
what needed to be
States,
said, and I think I said I was honest about
stated,
it. So happy
as relationship with the U.S.
So it was hard to make out Stuart there, but he said that, you know, this is an important exercise in democracy and he doesn't want to see it being made a mockery of. And then Aviva asks if he's happy with how it goes down. And he says, well, I spoke honestly, so I'm as happy as can be. The final thing I'll play for you. So Aviva, who honestly was there to cover the debates and not the journalists, was able to get this eyewitness account from journalist Ethan Cox of Ricochet.
So when I got here, just shortly before 7, before the debate was supposed to start, the security door was locked down. And so there was a group of us outside waiting. We didn't know what was going on. We were told there's a security issue of some kind. So after about 5 minutes, they let us in. We come in, and we see that what the security incident is that Ezra Levant is, like, in a loud, heated exchange with several people. It was hard to see exactly who because it was scrummed. All of the media, all of the cameras were surrounding him. But there was just a huge incident prior to the debate, which Ezra was at the center of. And, in fact, that only stopped because somebody yelled at the top of their lungs, Ezra, can you scrum somewhere else? We want to watch the debate. And that was the only point at which he actually moved out of the way, and that was undone. So I definitely place blame on the debate commission for making the decision to cancel the Q&A. That was a bad decision. But to the extent that they're saying it was a security concern, very clearly that security concern has a name, and it's Ezra Levant.
Jan Wong.
It's exhausting.
It's idiotic. It's exhausting. It's sophomoric. Who's to blame?
The commission. The debates commission. I mean, you have to figure out that you want journalists at a scrum with the leaders. You don't want advocates. You don't want activists. You don't want people who aren't journalists. And you have to be courageous enough to say to someone, you're not a journalist.
But they did. That was their initial position, and then they got sued.
Well, then you better say it again. Go through the courts again. Or else, you know, I mean, you told the Green Party they couldn't be on stage. Have a little guts and tell people who rent a truck to drive around and say, you know, one of the leaders is bad. You should be able to have the guts to say you're disqualified from covering this as media because you're a partisan, you're an advocate.
This is the part of our show where Jesse says things that will make him even more unpopular with other journalists.
Go ahead, knock yourself out.
Stuart Benson bears a lot of the blame for this.
Why?
At a professional event, as the nation's journalists were getting ready, like shortly before a debate was about to start, he's having some conversation with Kian and gets heated and starts yelling a tirade because he was understandably upset that these guys had crashed. And, man, you know, I think it was a combination of professional frustration that he's there trying to actually report. And obviously, you know, he doesn't like these guys, which I don't think many journalists do. And he goes from his argument with Kian Bexty to yelling at Ezra in this pedantic way, like he's going to prove to everybody around, like, reasonable frustrations, but like, what's he going to do? He's going to yell to prove that Ezra's not a real journalist. And then what's going to happen? Like, is this the place to do that?
Okay. So he's losing it, but I don't think you can blame him. You know, this whole thing is happening in Washington, D.C. and with the White House, in the White House press briefing room. They're kicking out the Associated Press because they refuse to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. The AP sued. They won. The White House said, nope, we're not doing it because they don't care what the courts say. And the White House is now appealing it. And more recently, they said, well, also Reuters and Bloomberg don't have automatic access. And they're bringing in the U.S. equivalent of Rebel Media into this. So this is not just a Canadian problem, but it's a problem. But at least in Canada, we only have this really idiotic debates commission that is allowing this to happen. In the White House, you know, it's Trump and his very young, inexperienced press secretary who's creating this havoc. But we have the same situation in two countries. And so I think it's too much to blame that reporter for, you know, losing it.
Not solely, but I think he bears some of the blame. And I actually agree with everything you just said. And I think it really illustrates the point, which is when it comes to press access, somebody's got to determine who gets it. And that might mean choosing who's a journalist and who isn't, or it might mean choosing who you like or who you don't. And in the case of the White House, we have a tyrannical president who is breaking all previous norms in picking his favorites and just overtly banishing people whose criticism he doesn't like and threatening.
And it's critical for reporting.
Right. We do not want the politician, the state.
Correct.
To be making that decision. So what do we have in Canada? Because we try to do things better. We had Trudeau say, okay, we're not going to say who's a journalist and who isn't. We're going to create an arm's length commission of experts like Craig Kielberger to determine who is and who isn't a journalist. And to their credit, they took that on and said, okay, we are not a political. And if the critics said, no, you are political because who appointed you? The Liberals appointed you. No, we're arm's length. We're not political. We're going to apply the same criteria to everybody. And we're going to say that the rebel can't come because they're not journalists. Now, any system where you've got some authority determining who's a journalist and who isn't, there has to be recourse if you're determined to not be a journalist, because that could be abused. Maybe not as directly as the president saying you're not a journalist, but you can't just have there be some, like, by fiat, the committee says this and that, you're done, right? So Levant went through the process that was available to him, which is a court challenge, and he won. So at that point, I actually don't know that we can blame the commission. I don't know that they had any choice but to let those guys in. I don't know what to do about this. I really don't.
I don't know either.
I mean, I guess you might say that rather than getting into a schoolyard screaming match with these guys who love that, who that's their bread and butter.
Yeah, now they're going to be in the news. Everybody's going to know about them.
We heard that at 9:30, when everybody else was leaving, Ezra was still there doing a selfie broadcast. Like, they just fed the troll the most delicious food. So that's not the answer. I understand the frustration of the journalists there, but I actually don't know what could be done about this. Like, I guess in this situation, maybe the best thing would have been to, like, I don't know, just deal with the fact that somebody who you find reprehensible also gets to ask questions.
But I think on Wednesday night after the French debate, didn't Jagmeet Singh just get asked a question? He said, I'm not answering it. I'm not talking to you. Like, that's the solution.
Thank you, but I'm not going to respond to an organization that promotes misinformation and disinformation like Rebel News. So no, I'm not going to respond to your question.
But of course, we don't want candidates to not talk to the media. So there's no solution. You're supposed to be able to figure it all out.
I can't. I don't know what to do in this situation. I don't know what to do. I'm very uncomfortable with any authority getting to determine who is and who isn't a journalist and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you can't.
But
you can't.
You have to have some kind of set of standards for an event like this, right? It became a clown show. A clown show? It was not good.
Clown show. The state and the government can never, ever determine who is a journalist. And we have citizen journalists who are legitimate and valid. And you don't have to get a degree in journalism to be a journalist. And you definitely don't want a licensed journalist. We've always objected to any kind of state licensing journalists because you have to have freedom of the press. But I'm not sure anybody anticipated in this online social media world people coming through with these agendas who are not journalists, but calling themselves journalists.
Nobody anticipated this. And even in the States, there's nobody like this. Ezra Levant is a walking, slippery slope rhetorical argument. You know, like in an argument where you're like, well, you start with this, eventually you'll have a guy who's actually got a truck outside the debates and he's got his so-called reporters in the debates, but he actually does that. And he takes everything to the extreme and then he'll take you to court, you know? Like, he's a really unique actor in our little political drama here. I don't know what we freeze frame on to end this little episode of our show, Jan, because I'm still in a bit of like a news manic high of like what the hell just went down. But the more I actually think about it as we talk, I'm like, this sucked.
Well, it's terrible because there was no chance to ask questions of the leaders, and we're 11 days, 10 days out from the election, and this was the chance. They don't talk to the media much, you know? So that's what's so sad about it. I guess you could blame a whole bunch of different people. You can blame Ezra Levant. You can blame the mainstream media who lost it. And you can blame the Leaders' Debate Commission for not vetting people properly.
They shouldn't have canceled the scrum. They should. Is our democracy that frail? Like, okay, some stupid went down. Throw somebody out if you have to. There was no violent threat.
They shouldn't. Okay, so that's another mistake. Who canceled? That must be the Leaders' Debate Commission. They're the only ones with the power.
Like, really? You couldn't have a press scrum because Ezra Levant would be there? You had to call the whole thing off? Really? Jan, on this show of ours, as you know, we duly note stories that might not otherwise get the attention that they deserve. Do you have anything to duly note?
Well, I think we should duly note something about the debate. I want to say that...
Oh, yeah! There was a debate!
Mark, remember?
The debate is the duly noted.
I watched it for 2 hours. Wow. I want to, get something in.
Our entire episode was about Ezra Levant, and the debate is the duly noted. Ezra obviously won. What would you like to... what will you duly note about the debate, Jen?
I'd like to duly note the moment, because Carney was getting dumped on by Pierre Poilievre all night, and towards the end, Carney looked at Pierre Poilievre and said,
I know you want to be running against Justin Trudeau. Justin Trudeau isn't here.
And I thought, I was like, oh, that was really good.
That was a good moment. Duly noted. Jan, this was a hell of a night. I'm so grateful you could be here with me for it.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks, Jesse.
That is our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about what you heard. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com, and I'm going to read everything that you send in. You can also find me posting on Blue Sky. Jan, where can people find you?
I am at, where am I? www.janwong.ca.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins. Fact check by Max Collins. I'm the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Election 2025 is a national election series airing on campus and community radio stations across Canada, bringing you diverse voices, in-depth conversations, and perspectives that are often unheard. The initiative is supported by the Covering Canada Elections 2025 Fund. Tune in live on April 28th for our election night coverage and visit altelxn.ca for more information.
What does existence mean to you? Collective Reflections, Queen's University's anti-oppression magazine, invites you to share your voice for Volume 12, Existence. From identity and resilience to celebrating cultural heritage, Collective Reflections welcomes poetry, short stories, essays, and visual art that showcase your unique perspective. Submissions are open now and due February 9, 2025. Let your creativity shine and be a part of this powerful collection. For questions or to submit, check out the AMS Social Issues Commission Instagram at Social Issues Commission. Don't miss your chance to be featured in Collective Reflections, Volume 12.
C. F.
R.
C.
101.9.